September 1st, Labor Day, 1997, and we are talking to Amos Kimball, lifelong Bayside resident, writing to our Men About Town.
My first years at Bayside are, as most who came in infancy, rather sketchy. My mother carried me over the threshold in 1932, and at least part of every summer since I have been here, but since my residence was only some 25 miles distant in the neighboring town of Newburgh, Maine, we were really in a position to come any time we wanted to, and so we might come and stay for 2 or 3 hours and then would return to Newburgh. But it is that my date is from 1932, which I find is some 65 years ago. Now, our mode of transportation in those days was much the same as it is today. My father, as did the other members of my family, have automobiles from an early date, and so it was by automobile that I came. However, the older members of my family who had occupied the cottage since it was built in the last decade of the 19th century, they came by horse and carriage or by steamer. And that was their main mode of transportation. This is the only cottage that I have ever stayed in at Bayside. As I said, other family members by the dozens had stayed in the cottage, largely before my time, as nearly all of them had passed away in my young adulthood.
I think we should mention that this cottage, what's the current address under the new postal scheme here?
The current address is number 10 Maple Street. Now that is the current designation. But in other years, it was simply called Maple Street, and it was as simple as that. I don't remember specifically who some of the earlier members of the community were. Names were passed by me in distant conversation, such as the Blaisdells, the Lothrops, the Clemences, and a host of other names. But I did not know them too personally, except Amy Blaisdell. I knew Amy, who was a cousin, and she used to visit us in Newburgh and also had some connections here in Bayside. I never was involved specifically in any group or organization as far as that goes in this area. I've always refrained from being too active in any organization. In those early days, a man by the name of E. Kelly Crosskill, who was Gordon Fuller's grandfather, he was very instrumental each summer in promoting an affair that was put on by the Shriners and through Anna Temple in Bangor. And Mr. Crosskill always seemed to be very active in that activity, and there would be one day every summer when the Shriners would come with all of their colorful regalia and the band and so on and so forth, and they would put on a very nice concert at the bandstand, which few can remember today, in Ruggles Park. That was one of the events, and of course, the other events, such as on the 4th of July and things like that, that we usually got here for the 4th, and we would have our own picnic lunch, and not particularly different from what we would experience today. I won't say that we have more people or less people here today than we did in those days. And then, of course, came the war years.
Where was the bandstand in Ruggles Park? What's there now in Ruggles Park?
It would be where the bandstand originally stood is just a little below the playground apparatus where the swings are. There's a little area down there where there was a bandstand. There are photographs in my collection of that show the bandstand. And that was a lot of fun. I remember they kept lawnmowers in underneath it. There was an opening in the latticework, and that's where the lawnmowers were stored. Now, I don't know of too many interesting stories that I could relate. Perhaps some of the most dramatic deal with the war years of World War II, when it was quietly reported that there were submarines located right out in the bay area. And I remember on one occasion, when we came down to check over the cottage, that the military personnel were here, and we were stopped, and we were very carefully examined before we could continue on to our property. And there are some very fascinating stories dealing with World War II, and some of those might be related by others who perhaps would be a few years older than I, who might recall more intimate detail. I remember one or two boating episodes dealing with some of the fellows who were some 10 years perhaps older than I, who had met with some sort of a mishap, but no casualties, I remember. But other than that, Bayside has maintained a pretty much a degree of serenity that sort of still pervades the atmosphere. It's sort of quiet and lackadaisical in attitude.
Well, it is now. It's after Labor Day.
This is Labor Day.
It's been a slow summer.
Mm. Well, of course, Maine, you understand, Harry, has two seasons. It's winter and July. And probably the big month for Bayside is probably July, although August now has its place, as does September, and there are still the hangers-on who will be here for the Columbus Day weekend in October. But by then, we must of necessity get closed up, and like the birds, we will disappear until sometime the following spring. Then we all seem to surface again.
Yeah, mud season.
And mud season and black fly season. A typical summer's day, of course, would entail getting up late in the morning and sitting up late at night. In my case, I go to bed before it is dark at night, and I prefer to be up early in the morning. But most Baysiders have a tendency not to have their breakfast before 11 in the morning. Or at least, that's my opinion. You asked me a few minutes ago if I had any old photographs. As I said, I have thousands of them. The availability has already been made to the general public in that the collection is now part of the Maine State Archives in Augusta. I was afraid that something might happen to that enormous collection, and so I thought the thing to do was to give it away before I gave in to the collection and it completely absorbed me. But there are still many wonderful photographs that are surfacing, wonderful photographs, and many yet remain to be identified. This, of course, will become, without question, a major aspect of the newly formed Bayside Historical and Development Society, which, of course, will over the years will accumulate, and eventually we will build up a fabulous archives, which, of course, belongs to the people of this area. And it is absolutely wonderful that this organization has been promoted and has now come to fruition. And I, for one, am quite delighted in that endeavor. I never was into boating. I've ridden, gone for a few boat rides around the bay and had some interesting experience, but I never owned a boat, neither did my father. He was going to buy a boat when he was about age, oh, I think around 36 years old, and I remember going down to Saturday Cove where we looked at a boat. He had negotiated to buy it, but we kind of shied away from it in the wake of the, I think, World War II was about to erupt, and so the boat episode didn't develop. I've never been involved in any of the municipal politics or anything to do with the community or that sort of thing, because I thought I would leave that up to those who might be more qualified than I. Neither would I want to be president of the United States, so that might explain many things. You asked me something. We dress just about the same then as we do now, very casually. Bayside has always been a sort of a casual place. We leave our tuxedos and our formality, for the most part, we leave it somewhere else. Bathing suits have always remained essentially the same, except, of course, those which the old photographs, which I have disclosed as being otherwise, that was more than a century ago. So essentially, that is in answer to some of your suggested questions, unless you have something else you'd like to elaborate upon.
If there's anything of interest that you can remember, any incidents? Or,
well, of course, there again, anything prior to 1932, and my years of memory, of course, scarcely go back to 1932. Other than that, I must rely on the memories of others who related different stories and situations to me, particularly my mother and other members of my family who were living in my young years. My grandmother came to Bayside in company with her aunt. This is before, well before the turn of the century. While they did not come to this cottage, she related some very interesting stories. One in particular, she remembered of a boarding one of the steamers at Hampden, and there were many steamers that touched here at Bayside, then called Northport. She would get on the boat with her sister, or sisters, sometimes the three girls would come, and with our aunt, was Elmira Hurst of Hampden, and they would, Aunt Elmira would bring her carriage and a span of horses, a team. Now, can you imagine a woman loading a top, what they called the top carriage? This was a surrey with closed insides, with brass lanterns, and she would come, bringing the girls with her, she would come to Bayside for a camp meeting. Now, this takes us back to an era, before Bayside really became Bayside. This takes us back to the Northport Wesleyan Grove Camp Meeting Association, and the very reason for the beginning here at Northport. In the 1840s, 1848 to be exact, and to give an example of what was going on, this whole area was nothing more than just an open pasture, which belonged to the cousins of my late great-great-uncle Jabez Knowlton in Newburgh. The Knowltons had a farm situated just northerly and westerly. The foundation, I believe, can still be located, not far from the mansion up on the hill. And they were approached in the year 1848 or 9, or thereabouts, and the acquisition was made for 25 acres of land. That is right near where Auditorium Park, right in that section. First camp meeting was held by this group of Methodists 1848 at Islesboro, but it was a little far removed from the mainland and a bit inaccessible for many. So in 1849, the acquisition of the land was made, and consequently, that was the beginning. A few years later, we find the first of the cottages that were being built, of the wooden cottage, the so-called, the wooden cottage type, so-called society houses. And it is remarkable that any of them have survived. During the interim period between the building of the cottages and the first camp meetings, or tent meetings, as they were called, came the Civil War, and following that activity, Northport really began to develop. Soon it was overcrowded. People came from far and wide. The tent meetings, or the camp meetings, were in full swing. And not only were the Methodists participating with the camp meeting activity, but there were campgrounds all over New England where people would congregate, usually the last 2 weeks in August, and they would congregate for the purpose of having and conducting their religious meetings. These Methodists were very zealous in their attachment. Consequently, groups of Methodists from neighboring communities pooled their money and built what we now refer to as the Society Cottages. These are indeed museum pieces. As time went on, that original 25 acres became terribly congested. There was too little room and too many people and more people to come, and so additional land was purchased, and by the 1870s we find the eruption, I would say. It was like a volcanic thing, the cottage city of the Penobscot. And these little cottages began to come up like so many mushrooms, all painted white, and many all trimmed with green, and they just began to sprout up and to appear, and the attraction to the upper middle class of the society in this area, the attraction was tremendous. And if you were somebody, you had a cottage at Northport. Well, there is some evidence, at least in my opinion, that a number of the cottages were pre-cut in some of the great mills on the Penobscot and were shipped by barge or schooner down the river, were unloaded, and were put together. There is more than a little evidence that some of these were prefabricated cottages. At any rate, the thing began to develop, and the prominent people who began to see this as a wonderful place, they began to realize that there was perhaps something more of an attraction than that of the Methodist religion, because all of them were not Methodists. There were many people of other faiths who came and became interested and eventually were to acquire property. Well, this went on through the building of two hotels, the laying out of the streets as we currently know them, the roads, the setting aside of green areas for park areas was very, very advanced for something of this type. And by the turn of the century, by 1900, things were in full swing. We have recorded documentary of sometimes several thousand people who would be here for the festivities, if you want to refer to them as festivities, during the camp meeting time. And as I said, usually the last 2 weeks in August, but this came stretched into not only the full month of August, but even a couple of weeks into September. But we have to keep in mind that in those days, there was something else that was going on that was also very important, and that was the rural fairs in Maine, the country fairs, and these people had to wind up their camp meeting activities in time to return to their homes so that they could go to the fairs. However, on the scene, by the turn of the century, and a few years after, was that mechanism that was designed called an automobile. And faint rumblings were heard from time to time, which was soon to make a radical change. By 1910, there were a number of people who were coming to Bayside, not by steamboat, not on Shank's mare, so to speak, walking, or bicycling, or by team, but they were coming by automobile. Among them was my own family. And Peg Lovejoy's folks, they had an automobile, as did Ira Cobb, Mr. Cobb and Annie, who came to Bohemia, that is where the Crowfoots live, and others, I think of Mr. Stowell. And I am still trying to identify the makes of some of these old cars. I'm working on that one. But I think Mr. Stowell, I think, had a Haynes, it may have been a Haynes Apperson, an enormous old piece of machinery. And of course, as these mechanisms slowly made their way around the highways and byways, all of which in those days were gravel.
If they were lucky.
If they were lucky. And the few remaining horses that were around shied away from the whole scene. 1920 is more so. And then, of course, in my own time, the demise of the steamers, no longer with steamboat stopping because folks were coming by auto. Now, maybe in the next century, those autos which we seem to know and recognize today will also be written into the pages of the past, and we will be coming by some other means of this travel.
The Cove, the Bohemian places you mentioned, that was Cove Summer.
That was Bohemia, where the Crowfoots live, was built by Ira Cobb prior to 1913, when they built the mansion up on the hill. And my mother recalled, since the uncle was acquainted with Ira, my mother recalled visits up to the new house, and she may possibly have visited them at Bohemia. I believe she did, but I regret that I don't have detailed information on that. The house, the big mansion on the hill, which is now on the National Register of Historic Landmarks, that house was built as a summer cottage, and it's quite a summer cottage. And I don't believe that either Mr. or Mrs. Kolb ever planned to live there year-round. But an interesting little tale was told me quite some years ago by one of the young carpenters who, at the time he told me, he had grown to be a very elderly man, but he worked, as he said, up on the job. And during that time, he occupied this cottage here at number 10 Maple, and his name was Simpson, Amos Simpson, was a cousin of my grandmother's, and Amos and his wife.
Any relation to Peter Simpson, the carpenter around here named Simpson?
Perhaps remotely. I don't think it's an immediate connection, since I have the Simpson, I have that lineage, and I don't think it's immediate, but however, quite possibly connected. Amos Simpson told me a fascinating little story. One day when some of the delivery people came and they found no sign. And so this was at the beginning of the construction on the mansion. And so one of the boys hastily grabbed up something for a scrap piece of wood and cut in the letters COBE, C-O-B-E. Now that's sometimes called Cobb, and I've seen many misspellings of Ira's name. It was Cobb, and so he cut that out with a jackknife, and it is the sign is now standing right beside my front door. I think that might make an interesting addition to the local historical society, in that it is the original sign to the mansion. However, the mansion was dubbed Hillside Farms, which few people know today. That was Hillside Farm, and he referred to it as the farm. And many, many stories were told concerning the Kolbs. They were very beneficent. They were very interested in the affairs of early Bayside. Did a tremendous amount of good with their money. They were not arrogant. They were very down-to-earth, ordinary, everyday people. Ira Kolb was, many enjoyed his company, and he was known to have entertained many, many people there during the years. On the death of Annie, there were no children in the family. On her death, he sort of slipped into the depths of depression. He became lonely and unhappy. And I believe he passed away when I was 2 years old in 1934, and that began another era with the purchase by Mr. and Mrs. Pingree. And that's another chapter in the history of the mansion. I suppose that at the time that the mansion was built, that there was a great deal of smiles throughout the general population as to why anyone would want to build such an enormous, huge, vast, as Jack Evans, the late Mr. Evans told me, he referred to it as a mausoleum. why they would want to do any such a thing as that in this area. But they did, and it certainly has been beautifully maintained over the years, and it's really quite a, I think it's a very important aspect of our area. It is, of course, on the National Register of Historic Landmarks. And interestingly enough, the Bayside area here was accorded the honor of being nominated to the National Register just a few months past. And strange to say, that Mr. Christensen, Clifford Christensen, his residence in Northport, or rather his residence in Thomaston, excuse me, beside the replica of the Knox Mansion, that too is on the National Register. And I might add that my property in Newburgh, the store of Chavis Knowlton, is also on the National Register. And I think that is rather significant to have three owners, Cliff and myself, and now Mrs. Evans, Jean Evans, and family, to have property that is has that distinction. And that is a very honorable position to hold. And I attended the hearings, and of course, when the formal presentation was made for the for that designation. And I think perhaps that the worth will be proven in the years to come.
50 people from a building total condominium here.
Well, I think I'm quite safe in saying that probably we are a rather selfish little group. All we want to do is to keep this nice little area for ourselves, and the proof that we enjoy other people coming to visit lies in the fact that we are on the National Register. We love to have people come and enjoy our little village, and if a property comes up for sale, maybe someone who would like to become a part of our own little community. And so, in other words, we just want to kind of hang on to it and keep it essentially the same as it has been since it was built. I don't think that is asking too much. I think it's a rather generous approach to society in general. That here we are, we have a nice little village, we love it the way it is, and we'd like to keep it the way it is. You're welcome to come. And if there's something that you see that you'd like to buy, become a part of it, we'd love to have you. The Methodist sermons, I might say, the Methodism perhaps has faded somewhat into the background. But I am now doing some research and am quietly making an acquisition of some of the old documentary, particularly books, and the things that some of our older connections valued so highly. I think this is important that that sort of thing be not entirely neglected. And who knows? The day may come when there may be a piece of property designated for a nice little museum. We don't know, but it could happen. We never know.
Nice.
It would be very nice. Preservation, I think, is very important. Perhaps some of us have preserved too many things. there are those.
Oh, nobody in this room, of course.
There are those in the community with whom I am personally acquainted who are avid collectors of all sorts of memorabilia. And I would almost designate one as my interviewer, Harry Rosenblum.
Well, me.
But it's an education. The whole thing is it's an education. And if we don't know where we have been, Harry, we don't know where we are now. And if we don't know where we are now, we will never know where we're going. It's as simple as that. The past is the key to the future. With that, I think I will conclude this first edition of the interview with the understanding that at a future date we may resume our conversation. This being September 1st of 1997, who knows? You may be interviewing me in another 40 years, if not sooner.
I certainly hope so.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Amos.